Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written and tell you how to access them. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will discover there some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice. After all, that has all been a misunderstanding. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of the book of Acts. We're in Acts chapter 12. We had just looked at the first several verses, so let us back up and review where we have been. Let me read the text first. Now about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now it was during the days of the feast of unleavened bread, and when he had seized him, he put Peter in prison, delivering him to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending, after the Passover, to bring him out before the people. So Peter was kept in the prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church. I had mentioned toward the end of the last program that in one of Clint Eastwood's films, he speaks to me this unforgettable line, "A man has to know his limits." Indeed he does, or he's on a headlong course for a collision with an indignant God. We see a monumental and notorious example of that in this text. What Luke records here is a historical particular, but like so many we encounter in biblical narrative, this historical particular exemplifies a larger historical pattern. Action on the part of the Holy Spirit, reaction on the part of Satan. God's Spirit we see moving as players, Satan we see moving as pawns. Where God creates advancement, Satan always attempts containment. Where the Lord sets in motion a force, the devil seeks to block with a counterforce. Here, in microcosm, is the macrocosm of spiritual warfare the world over in every generation. Where God creates attraction, the devil will attempt to create distraction. You see that throughout church history. You see it in every generation. And why do I mention these things? Because to be forewarned, friends, is to be forearmed. Ignorance of reality is the mother of fatality. To be aware of these dynamics is to be alert, to be less susceptible to discouragement and less prone to fall into his traps. When the text opens in verse 1, and now about that time, that's around the same time as Barnabas and Saul came to Jerusalem bringing a contribution offered by the church at Antioch to relieve the need of famine-stricken believers in Judea. This particular Herod was the free-spending playboy grandson of Herod the Great, and he exhibited some of his grandfather's same affinities for cruelty. He knew that the Christian Jews were regarded by the Jewish establishment as a noxious and pestilent sect in their midst. So Herod attempted to ingratiate himself with the Jewish establishment by persecuting the church in their midst. So he rounded up some of their leaders. We don't know how many, but among them was James, the apostle, the brother of John. And James he executed on some pretext or other not mentioned by Luke. And then when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also in verse 3. Luke notes that it was during the days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, so that scruple of creating confusion and desecrating the feast by having Peter immediately executed explains the delay in disposing of Peter and throwing him in jail. But in verse 4, he delivered him to a squad of four soldiers. It was his intent after the Passover to bring him out to the people, you know, a show trial like those that used to be held in the Soviet Union during the days of Stalin. Seems like overkill. There were four soldiers to a squad and four different squads to cover all 24 hours. Why this overkill in guarding Peter? Well, as I mentioned toward the end of the last program, Herod was apprised of what had happened before. That was back in chapter 5, verses 17 through 23. On that occasion, Peter and John had been supernaturally sprung by an angel of the Lord. Herod had no intention of allowing such a cock and bull story to be any excuse for anybody to escape his clutches on this occasion. Besides, I personally suspect he was not unaware of the claims of the resurrection when the body of Jesus somehow came up missing despite a Roman guard on the scene. So Herod was not going to allow his bad intentions toward Peter to be foiled by any shenanigans, natural or supernatural, this time around. There would be no excuses for the accused showing up for his date with injustice. Well, the church, meanwhile, was not sitting on its hands. Crisis was and remains the catalyst for intense intercession, and intense intercession is in turn the catalyst for another step in our spiritual progression. So Peter was kept in prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God. One thing you can take to the bank. Whenever you see a faithful church mobilized around a single prayer, the more likely you are to see a faithful God mobilized in power to answer it. We should take note of that word fervently, ekstenos in Greek. It connotes not only intensity of prayer, but also prolixity, meaning stretched out or strained. Vine says the idea is not relaxing in effort, not just intense, but unremitting. And the point I made earlier is illustrated in what happens next. Their intensity in corporate intercession is matched by the drama of divine intervention. That is often the case. I cannot recall in the whole biblical record a single instance where a whole group of faithful people implored God for some intervention that he denied. We read in verse 6, on that very night, when Herod was about to bring Peter forward, Peter was sleeping. He was manacled between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and the guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. I mean, this was locked now. Herod thought he had secured his prisoner so that not even Houdini could figure out a way of escape. Herod, like all of his worldly breed, never grasped that nothing can thwart the purposes of God. When God determines to act, he will act, and he will act successfully. For in verse 7 we read, "Behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell, and he struck Peter's side and roused Peter, saying, 'Get up quickly,' and his chains fell off his hands." First of all, don't you marvel at the serenity of the apostle, who is only hours from the executioner's sword. I mean, how is one able somehow to fall into a deep sleep even as he stares right into the bloody jaws of death? That is the kind of peace that the Lord gives those who know with assurance that they are smack dab in the middle of God's will. The Proverbs say, "He who listens to me shall live securely and shall be at ease from the dread of death." Proverbs 1:32. Now look, that doesn't mean that we necessarily will be secure from death. But here's the point. We will be at ease from the dread of it. That peace belongs to those who know they are in dead center of the bullseye of God's will. It's also that kind of grace and peace we call dying grace. It doesn't usually reveal itself until the threat presents itself. With Peter, I am sure that he was of the same spirit as the Apostle Paul. When Paul faced an uncertain fate at the hands of Caesar, he said, Philippians 1:21, I paraphrase slightly, to tell you the truth, I'm torn between living and dying. For me, to die is gain, for that is to be with Christ. And to live is gain, for that is to serve Christ right here on earth. Here's another phenomenon that I marvel at, and we've seen it before, and that is the efficiency of God's ways of working. Our God has this uncanny ability, like a laser, in that it goes right to its target with no collateral effects he does not intend. Here's what I mean. Notice in this divine intervention how nothing in God's exertions is wasted. Nothing is gained from it by those unbelievers on the periphery of it. For Peter's deliverance all unfolded in such a bounded way that his wicked, hard-hearted guards never knew what happened. Light showed up in the cell, but did they see it? Apparently not. Peter was awakened, but were they? No. Peter's chains fell off. Did theirs? No, apparently not. Peter went free, but they remained in prison. Oh my, in that prose, there is a parable, friends, if we have eyes to see it. That experience is in many ways an illustration of God's saving work. At some point, God intervened in our lives. God touched us, and we woke up, but the world around us remains asleep. We saw the light of God, but the world right beside us does not. Our chains of sin fell off by the power of God, but they remain in their sins and in their stupor. What a metaphor is this of the whole salvation experience. What a metaphor of the way the redemptive power of God goes like a laser right to the target of God's elective grace, leaving the unbelieving outside that loop, no more than puzzled and groping for explanations, but still chained and unbelieving. My, I don't know how striking that is to you, but it certainly is to me. And the angel said to Peter, gird yourself and put on your sandals. And he did so. And the angel said to him, wrap your cloak around you and follow me. Now here's an interesting thing that I have noted before. It is this. God is conservative or economical in the exertion of his supernatural power. What do I mean? Folks, when it serves some strategic purpose to exert direct supernatural power to achieve his divine ends, and or when the situation is beyond human control, for example, Peter could not extricate himself from this situation by any means then available, it's then that God will bring in the big gun, so to speak. For example, consider this. As this narrative unfolds, this is Easter. The night air is cold. The angel does not wrap Peter up like a mother may wrap a child against the elements. Nor does the angel supernaturally put on Peter's shoes to protect his soles against harsh treatment from rough roadways as Peter makes his escape. Peter's instructed to do all that. On the other hand, as we will see, as Peter was making his prison break, an enormous iron gate blocked his exit, verse 10. The angel caused that big iron gate to open spontaneously for him. Moreover, you will notice that so long as the angel's assistance in defeating circumstances stood in the way, the angel remained with Peter. But just as soon as the apostle was fully awake and fully aware and no longer disoriented by this stunning development and all the insuperable obstacles to his freedom were cleared, it's then that the angel departed. The principle, I think, is this. Generally, God works his will through secondary instruments or means. We call it providence. And it's just as effective. But when it serves God's strategic advantage, or I repeat, when obstacles to his purpose require it, God will act directly, but conservatively or economically, that is, doing only what the situation or his purposes require. God will never put on a sound and light show just to impress people. God is always economical in his direct interventions on our behalf. Never expect him to waste his powder on what he has equipped us to do for ourselves. I remember a situation that was a moment of profound discouragement for me. I was going on vacation, and in one way it was a good time to be going on vacation. Another way it was a very bad time because there was a lot of unfinished business, and I just hated to leave the church at that time. I told my wife, and of course, after all these years, she knows me well, and she knows when I'm just frustrated and popping off a little bit, and she knows when I am dead serious. And on this occasion, something had happened. It was one of those straws that broke the camel's back, so to speak. I was so discouraged, and I had just, as a result of this, my confidence that God's hand was on me had just collapsed. I had never been quite at that place before. It was a very difficult moment. I told Ossie about it. I said, you know, honey, we're going on this vacation. I can't continue unless God speaks to me in some way that he's never spoken to me before and lets me know that his hand is upon me, that he is with me, and that there is no turpitude or ineptitude on my part that's caused him to withdraw his hand. I just don't know what's going on, but I've got to have help. Well, we get on the plane and we fly off to the place of our annual vacation. And I get a chance every morning when I'm there to walk 6 or 7 miles each morning along the beach. It's a great time. It's still cool at that time and enjoyable and not too many people out. And it's a long prayer time. And every morning I'd say, Lord, I can't go back the way things are. My spirit is broken. So day after day, I prayed and nothing was happening. And one afternoon, we went over to a Costco in that town, Naples, Florida, where we were staying. And I was walking along by the books. Most of the books carried by Costco are not anything that I would regard of a substance, not anything that I would ordinarily buy, a few here and there. And all of a sudden, I came across one, and the minute I saw it, I wondered, Costco? It was a biography of Jonathan Edwards by George Marston. And it was for a historical book, a biographical book, a bit on the heavy side. Jonathan Edwards was kind of a heavyweight character. I certainly wanted to get the book, and I did. And I took it home and added it to my reading stack. And I gave it priority, jumped into it immediately. I don't think I was in that book 100 pages until I was thanking God profusely, telling the Lord, this is the way you've chosen to speak to me. The very issues with which I was having a problem were answered and were illustrated, without going into more detail about it, in the content of that book. And I still thank the Lord. It's one of my great monuments to this day. I still regularly thank the Lord for what I call that Jonathan Edwards monument. It dealt with the peculiar questions that I had. God knew me, and he knew that he could accomplish his purpose, and he could reassure me without going into any waste of supernatural energy. Secondary means would do it. I didn't know what would do it. I just knew that the Lord needed to speak to me in some way that I could understand and I could know that is the Lord's provision. And that's what we regularly see in the course of our Christian lives. When God needs to bring up the big guns, when he needs to do something that is directly supernatural, he can do that. He's done it throughout all of history. But that is not his regular way. He is a conservative. He's an economical God. And his ordinary way is to work through means to accomplish his purpose. There was no means that would have extricated Peter from that situation. Not at all. It wasn't available. So the Lord brought in an angel. And so it is that the Lord always works. So far as I can see throughout the history of biblical revelation, throughout church history, it works like that. And I mention that to save people a lot of grief and a lot of disillusionment. There are those who seem to think that God always works in a direct supernatural way, that you should expect a miracle a day. And in order to get support for that idea, they have to so reduce the idea of a miracle to the point that it is ridiculous, that any provision God makes is a miracle. And that's deceiving. And it can be very disillusioning. Don't go there. Just understand the reality. In this case, direct supernatural intervention was needed, but it was not at every level, as you can see. So in verse 9, Peter went out and he continued to follow, and he didn't know that what was being done by the angel was real. Peter was still in a certain state of confusion. He thought he was seeing a vision. To one having a vision, the line between a vision and reality is initially blurred, just as it is for us, at least for me, when we're having certain dreams, they seem so totally real that sometimes we wake up not knowing for a minute whether our dream was fact or fantasy, so much so that sometime we may need a little time to settle down. I'm sure you've had dreams, nightmares like that, as I have, and sometimes I just woke up with a start, sometimes in a sweat, and it just took me a minute to get hold of myself and to realize, oh, thank God. Thank God I didn't do that. Thank God I wasn't in that situation. Thank God that was not real. Whew. And we can't even think about going back to sleep because it seemed so real. Well, that's the way it came down with Peter. And when they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate, which leads to the city, which I've already mentioned. And here's direct supernatural intervention. Peter couldn't have done this by himself. They opened for them, for Peter and the angel by itself. And they went out, and they went along one street. And okay, the angel, direct supernatural intervention, was no longer needed. So Peter is on his own. Immediately the angel departed from him. And when Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent his angel, and he's rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting. This whole experience has been just surreal, as you would expect." Now Peter is fully conscious that this whole deal is for real, and he understands that the Lord has preempted the malicious intentions of Herod. It's clear that the Lord has once again frustrated the bloodlust of the Jewish people who despised the Jewish Christians in their midst. And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who is called Mark, the author of the Gospel of Mark, where many were gathered together and they were praying. And when he knocked at the door of the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. When she recognized Peter's voice, well, because of joy, she did not open the gate. She forgot herself. She ran in. She announced that Peter was standing at the front gate. They said to her, "You're out of your mind." But she kept insisting that it was so. They kept saying, "It's his angel." But Peter continued knocking. You can see that. And when they opened, they saw him. They were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of prison. And he said, "Report these things to James," meaning the brother of Jesus, "and to the brethren." And he departed and went to another place. Evidently, John Mark's family was well off and had a spacious home with an outer gate leading to an inner courtyard surrounding the main house. Very likely, one congregation of Jewish Christians were using it as a meeting place. And from past experience, Peter knew they would be gathered there. There's something very interesting in this patch of narrative, the realism of the whole scenario, but I'll come back to that the next time. For now, our time has expired. God bless you, dear friends. Have a wonderful day and join us again next time.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.